From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now!
I would not give up this fight if there was a chance that we would prevail. But it is now clear that even when all the provisional ballots are counted, which they will be, there won't be enough outstanding votes for us to be able to win Ohio. And therefore, we cannot win this election.
We will continue our economic progress. We'll reform our outdated tax code. We'll strengthen the Social Security for the next generation. We'll make public schools all they can be. And we will uphold our deepest values of family and faith.
The Republican Party now controls the presidency, the Senate, the House, the Supreme Court, every federal judiciary circuit, the majority of governorships and state legislatures.
It turns out that moral values eclipsed even the economy, the war on terror, and the war on Iraq as top concerns for voters, which may have pushed Bush over the top.
Today, we'll look at the underpinnings of the Republican victory and its right-wing media infrastructure.
George Bush's victory in the election Tuesday night was also a victory for the media infrastructure that the conservatives have built over the past quarter century.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. The showdown is over, or some would say it's just beginning. The presidential race is over. Senator John Kerry conceded in a phone call to President Bush yesterday morning, ending the 2004 race. Bush held a victory rally at the Ronald Reagan Building in Washington and appeared on stage with his family and Vice President Dick Cheney. Bush enters his second term after winning the popular vote by 3.5 million. He's the first president to win more than half of the vote in 16 years. And the Republicans have strengthened their control over both the House and the Senate. The Kerry campaign had vowed not to concede until every vote was counted in Ohio. But the Massachusetts senator conceded yesterday after determining there were not enough uncounted voters to make up the difference. At 11 a.m., John Kerry called President Bush and then addressed supporters a couple of hours later at Faneuil Hall in Boston. Kerry called on the nation to, quote, begin the healing. Speaking at his victory rally, Bush said, quote, America has spoken and I'm humbled by the trust and confidence of my fellow citizens. With that trust comes a duty to serve all Americans, and I will do my best to fulfill that duty every day as your president. Today, Bush will be meeting with his cabinet for the first time since August 2nd. There's been much speculation about the future of that cabinet revolving around the possible departures of Secretary of State General Colin Powell, Attorney General John Ashcroft, Homeland Security Director Tom Ridge. The Guardian of London reports two of the administration's most hawkish officials, Paul Wolfowitz and John Bolton, may be in place for big promotions. While Bush spoke of reaching out to all Americans, early indications show the administration plans to move to the right. Vice President Dick Cheney said yesterday, President Bush ran forthrightly on a clear agenda for the nation's future, and the nation responded by giving him a mandate. Chief neoconservative writer Norman Podhoretz said Bush's victory vindicated the neoconservative movement, and he urged Bush to fight what he calls World War IV against the country's enemies. Conservative Christian leader Richard Vagary said yesterday, now comes the revolution. If you don't implement a conservative agenda now, when do you? In a memo sent to other conservative Christians, Vagary wrote, quote, make no mistake, conservative Christians and values voters won this election for George W. Bush and Republicans in Congress. Vagary went on to write, quote, it's crucial that the Republican leadership not forget this. In Britain, the country's papers have issued stinging criticism of the U.S. electorate for backing Bush. The Daily Mirror asked how 59 million people could, quote, be so dumb. The cover of the London Independent reads, four more years, with pictures of Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib, and scenes from the Iraq invasion. Many foreign leaders publicly congratulated President Bush, but Moody Awori, the vice president of Kenya, was a bit less diplomatic in his reaction. Awori said, quote, "To me, I think we're going to see more dictatorship on an international scale. We're going to see more extremism come out of there. We're going to see even more isolationism where America will not bother about the United Nations. To me, it's a very sad affair." In the Senate, the Republicans now hold a 55-45 edge, and the makeup of the Senate has moved sharply to the right, as several conservative Republicans won seats previously held by retiring Democrats from the South. One of the new senators, Tom Coburn from Oklahoma, is a leading opponent of abortion and supports executing doctors who perform illegal abortions. In other news from Election Day in San Francisco, 64% of the city's voters supported a resolution calling for the U.S. government to withdraw its troops from Iraq. In Albany, New York, voters elected David Soros as the country's new district attorney. Soros gained national attention for campaigning on a platform of reforming the state's harsh Rockefeller drug laws. The Drug Policy Alliance hailed Soros' victory as a sign that candidates can run and win on a platform that calls for sensible drug law reform. In other news, Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat's health has taken a turn for the worse. He's been placed in critical care, and there have been reports he's fallen into a coma. He's being treated at a military hospital in France. Haaretz is reporting that senior Palestinian Authority officials have rushed to Ramallah for emergency meetings. The Executive Committee of the Palestine Liberation Organization and the Central Committee of the Fatah Movement were both urgently summoned to Arafat's headquarters. Former Palestinian Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas was also en route to the compound. Hungary announced it'll pull its 300 troops out of Iraq by April. The country's prime minister said, quote, "To stay there much longer is impossible." And in Afghanistan, the U.S.-backed Hamid Karzai has been officially declared the winner in last month's presidential election.
America, how are you? I'm just calling to check in. So lately you've not been yourself. I think you've forgotten something. You've forgotten yourself. You've forgotten who you are. You become the midnight bully, standing up behind the bar, shoving dollars in your pockets with bootleggers in the back. Got the cops out in the front room, making sure the decks are stacked. And you think that you are winning, but this ain't no poker game. 'Cause you're not looking out the front door to see the ones who curse your name. 'Cause you've stolen and you've plundered in the name of liberty. Sold your soul to the highest bidder, and still you claim that you are free. So I'm calling to remind you.
America, how are you? Erica Luckett here on Democracy Now! I am Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country. Well, the 2004 elections have ended with President Bush winning a second term and the Republican Party gaining more power in the Senate and the House. Yesterday afternoon, Senator Kerry conceded in a speech before supporters in Boston.
You may not understand completely in what ways, but it is true when I say to you that you have taught me and you've tested me and you've lifted me up and you've made me stronger. I did my best to express my vision and my hopes for America. We worked hard and we fought hard, and I wish that things had turned out a little differently. But in an American election, there are no losers, because whether or not our candidates are successful, the next morning we all wake up as Americans. And that is the greatest privilege and the most remarkable good fortune that can come to us on earth. With that gift also comes obligation. We are required now to work together for the good of our country. In the days ahead, we must find common cause. We must join in common effort, without remorse or recrimination, without anger or rancor. America is in need of unity and longing for a larger measure of compassion. I hope President Bush will advance those values in the coming years. I pledge to do my part to try to bridge the partisan divide. I know this is a difficult time for my supporters, but I ask them, all of you, to join me in doing that. Now more than ever, with our soldiers in harm's way, we must stand together and succeed in Iraq and win the war on terror. I will also do everything in my power to ensure that my party, a proud Democratic Party, stands true to our best hopes and ideals. I believe that what we started in this campaign will not end here. And I know our fight goes on to put America back to work and to make our economy a great engine of job growth. Our fight goes on to make affordable health care an accessible right for all Americans, not a privilege. Our fight goes on to protect the environment, to achieve equality, to push the frontiers of science and discovery, and to restore America's reputation in the world. I believe that all of this will happen, and sooner than we may think, because we're America, and America always moves forward.
A defeated Senator John Kerry speaking at Faneuil Hall in Boston. Soon after, President Bush in Washington, D.C., held his victory party at the Ronald Reagan Building.
Because we have done the hard work, we are entering a season of hope. We will continue our economic progress. We'll reform our outdated tax code. We'll strengthen the Social Security for the next generation. We'll make public schools all they can be. And we will uphold our deepest values of family and faith. We'll help the emerging democracies of Iraq and Afghanistan. So they can grow in strength and defend their freedom. And then our servicemen and women will come home with the honor they have earned. With good allies at our side, we will fight this war on terror with every resource of our national power, so our children can live in freedom and in peace. Reaching these goals will require the broad support of Americans. So today I want to speak to every person who voted for my opponent. To make this nation stronger and better, I will need your support, and I will work to earn it. I will do all I can do to deserve your trust. A new term is a new opportunity to reach out to the whole nation. We have one country, one Constitution, and one future that binds us. And when we come together and work together, there is no limit to the greatness of America. Let me close with a word of the people of the state of Texas. We have known each other the longest, and you started me on this journey. On the open plains of Texas, I first learned the character of our country, sturdy and honest, and as hopeful as the break of day. I will always be grateful to the good people of my state, and whatever the road that lies ahead, that road will take me home. The campaign has ended, and the United States of America goes forward with confidence and faith. I see a great day coming for our country, and I am eager for the work ahead. God bless you, and may God bless America.
President Bush speaking yesterday in Washington, D.C. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Juan, you've been doing a lot of looking at the numbers, at the votes around the country.
Yes, you know, and I think that it's very important in elections like this to try to really get a sense of what was happening on the ground. There's a tendency often to look at the overall numbers, but anyone who's actually been involved in elections process knows that what happens at the precinct level really determines pretty much what your picture of this election was. And some of the things, as I looked around the country yesterday, spent quite a bit of time looking at the numbers, a few things struck me. Number one is the enormous consolidation of the African-American vote, not only in terms of numbers, but in terms of percentages against the Republican Party. Washington, D.C., for instance, a much higher percentage of people voting for the Democrats and larger numbers than last time. Duval County, the infamous Duval County in Jacksonville, huge turnouts.
In Florida.
In Jacksonville, Florida, huge turnouts in the black community, but also huge turnouts among whites in Duval County as well, so that there was a 44% increase in the black in the Democratic turnout and a 42% increase in the Republican turnout. Enormous increases. At the same time, the other thing is the enormous problems with our electoral system. It's unbelievable. It's astounding that people had to wait 10 hours in some places in Ohio to vote. One fellow reporter of mine at the New York Daily News spent 5.5 hours online in eastern Pennsylvania when he went home in the evening to vote. It's unbelievable that in a country as advanced as we are, that people have to spend virtually a whole day to vote in some of these urban areas. Voting being like making sausage, when you see the actual numbers, I think Greg Palast mentioned a little bit about New Mexico, but I took a closer look at New Mexico yesterday, and I'm astounded at the vote results. There's no way you can tell what happened in New Mexico right now. Just to give you examples, in Taos County, in just one electoral district that the state posted the returns on yesterday, out of 505 people who voted, according to the county, in that one precinct, only 359 votes have been tallied. 146 are missing. At least there's no apparent indication of how 30% of the people in that one precinct voted. In other precincts, hundreds of votes more than the number of people who the state says actually voted.
In the example of Taos, and you say 30%, you don't even know how they voted. How about the others? How did they skew?
Well, overwhelmingly, there's about, from what I can tell in New Mexico, there's about 7,000 unaccounted for votes, that people who actually voted and supposedly the results are in. But when you add up the presidential candidates' votes and everyone under that, none of them total the same number. So you're looking at maybe 7,000 who just either, for some reason or other, their votes were discounted or they don't appear. And so I would say that given the fact that it's about 13,000, I think the difference there, that is very, very hard to tell what's happened in New Mexico in terms of who will eventually be declared the winner.
I mean, what's interesting about Taos is it's probably one of the most democratically concentrated areas of New Mexico.
Yes, and it's also, for instance, San Juan County in New Mexico, that is 52% Native American and Latino, but yet somehow turned up 65% for Cheney and Bush, and 823 votes there are missing in that county. So that there are quite a few places throughout New Mexico where I think that there has to be a closer look. And I think in Ohio, one of the things that amazed me about the results posted by the state so far is that they're only at the county level. They're not at the precinct level. So you really don't know what's happened in Ohio yet until you see the precinct level votes, which is how most people identify their communities and their neighborhoods, and you can get a better idea. So I think that and as I spoke to quite a few returning New Yorkers who were in New Mexico and Ohio who are on their way back now, I remember one particular person who grew up in southern Ohio and spent months there during this past year in Cincinnati trying to turn out the Democratic vote. He told me, and this is a white labor activist here in New York, he told me, I know southern Ohio, and ultimately it was about race. Race was the one question, one thing that was not talked about in this election. But the Democratic Party has become the party of black people in America, and of Hispanics and of immigrants, and many of the people who were voting know that, and who came out in large numbers, and that increasingly this conservative and racist vote, which in large measure it is, has consolidated itself in its opposition to the Democratic Party as the party of black people. And that explains the enormous consolidation of the Republican rule in the South. It used to be that the Democratic Party had all the racist Dixiecrats in it. Now all the Dixiecrats have left the Democratic Party. I guess the last one was what's his name is escaping me now at the Republican convention.
Zell Miller.
Zell Miller was one of the last of the Dixiecrats who finally moved over. But essentially, all of the Dixiecrats and their constituents in the South have all moved now into the Republican Party, and that's created the enormous consolidated vote, Republican Party vote in the South.
Well, we're going to break, and we're going to come back and look at the structural underpinnings of the Republican victory. And we're going to start at the top, presidency, Supreme Court, Republican Party consolidation of their control in the House and the Senate, the federal judiciary level, the majority of governorships in this country, as well as state legislatures. We're going to be speaking with Jamin Raskin of American University, and we're going to be talking about the issues of moral values that are being discussed more and more. Who is the value voter, the value voter, with Esther Kaplan, author of With God on Their Side, How Christian Fundamentalists Trampled Science, Policy, and Democracy in George W. Bush's White House. And we'll speak with Bob Perry, former AP and Newsweek reporter, who's looking at the right-wing media infrastructure that has helped to enable this victory. Stay with us.
I've been waiting for something to happen. And the sound of the crowd in my ear. You might ask what it takes to remember when you think that you've heard it before. How governments lie to their people and how nations are driven to war. There are shadows on the faces of the men who fan the flame. Shows and TV, you hear one thing again and again, how the USA stands for freedom and how we come to the aid of a friend. Well, who are these ones we call our friend? These governments killing their own? Or is it the ones who can't take anymore, so they pick up a brick or a gun or a stone? There are lives in the balance.
enemies are, but they're never around.
Richie Havens, Lives in the Balance. Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the largest public media collaboration in this country. Broadcasting on close to 300 radio and TV stations, on Pacifica stations and NPR stations, public access TV stations, as well as PBS stations. We welcome KRCB throughout Northern California, and I look forward to seeing folks tonight at Stanford University, at Kresge Auditorium, as we have a discussion and post-mortem analysis on the elections tomorrow night in San Diego. We're also broadcasting on both satellite networks, on Free Speech TV, which is channel 9415 of Dish Network, also 9410 there on Link TV, and Link TV is on channel 375 of Direct TV as well. And if you want to bring us to your community, just go to our website and you can find out how two to three stations a week are picking us up. We're going to now talk about the Republican victory. Really, you might say, landslide in the sense of consolidating power in this country. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We're joined on the telephone, in the studio in Washington, by Jamin Raskin of American University, law professor. Jamie, right now we're looking at Republican consolidation of power over not only the presidency, Supreme Court, Senate, House, federal judiciary, the majority of governorships, and state legislatures. Can you talk about the significance of this and the structural underpinnings?
Well, I think Juan put his finger on what's going on here, which is that our political institutions were structured by a determination to protect slavery in the South. And so all of our political institutions have a pro-Southern tilt to them. The Electoral College can only be understood as being intertwined with the history of slavery and white supremacy in the country. The Southern states were looking for a way to combine the disproportionate power they got through the U.S. Senate with the House of Representatives, where they got disproportionate power through the Three-Fifths Clause, counting the slaves, 60% of the slaves, to inflate the power of the slave masters in their congressional delegations. And so the Electoral College worked like a dream for the Southern states. Four out of our five first presidents were slave masters. And the Electoral College, all the way up through the 20th century and through today, has operated to give disproportionate power to the South, and specifically to the most conservative backward forces in the South. And we just saw that played out again yesterday. In the 20th century, there were a number of conservative Dixiecrats who left the Democratic Party in presidential elections, like George Wallace, like Harry Byrd, like Strom Thurmond, and ran for president as independents to send a message to the Democratic Party about how the civil rights movement should not be joined and should not be supported. And the Electoral College has always been a lever against civil rights progress. And today, it now acts to support the most conservative forces in the country that want to increase corporate power, that don't want to deal with issues like health care for the people, that don't want to deal with environmental protection, and so on. And we're getting a kind of one-party lockup of the political system through the Republican Party control of the House, the Senate, the White House, the Supreme Court, the federal judiciary, and all of these different levers of power go to reinforce one another, as we saw in 2000 when a five-justice majority, all appointed by Republicans on the Supreme Court, moved to hand Bush a victory in the Electoral College, despite the fact that he was down 500,000 votes. And they've been able to use the last 4 years, with their control over the federal budget, with their control over the federal government, with their support in the corporate media, to consolidate their political power. So if you believe the central insight of our founders about checks and balances, we're in a dangerous situation to have one-party control over all of our major political institutions.
I'd like to ask you also, because I'll never forget the conversation I had many years ago with Ruben Franco, who at that time was the head of the Puerto Rican Legal Defense and Education Fund, as he was on a train to Washington to the Justice Department to argue over redistricting. This was in the early 1990s. And his lawyer was Rudy Giuliani, who was very much in favor of supporting the creation of a new Latino district in New York. And in essence, the Republicans strategically in in the early 90s made a decision to support the creation of these some of these minority districts all around the country. And they were basically appeasing the African-American and Latino upper classes in seeking to get some more seats, but in essence diluted the minority vote in the rest of the country by compacting it into these 80% minority districts, 60% minority districts, which would guarantee the Charlie Rangels and other political representatives of the world perpetual seats, but would in essence create opportunities for the Republicans throughout the rest of the country. And obviously this is what DeLay just did in Texas to forestall the new majority that is developing in Texas by rearranging the seats there and being responsible primarily for the big Republican gain this time around.
Right. Well, I mean, that's an enormously complex issue. On the one hand, the Rehnquist Court in Shaw versus Reno and Miller versus Johnson were saying that it's unconstitutional to create majority black and Hispanic districts that have a bizarre configuration or bizarre perimeter to them. On the other hand, the Republicans were pushing to pack as many racial minorities, i.e. Democrats, into districts as possible to create extremely Democratic districts and then to, in effect, bleach or whiten the neighboring districts. And ultimately, the Supreme Court acceded to that Republican strategy. But the big problem here, and this is what I think we have to keep our eyes on, is the way that politicians get to choose their own voters through the legislative redistricting process. And we saw that happen in Texas, where the DeLay-engineered re-gerrymandering of the congressional districts led to a wipeout of four white Texas Democrats in this election. But, you know, outside of Texas, only three congressional incumbents of either party lost in the entire country. And that's because gerrymandering has been perfected as a computerized art now, where the members of Congress, through their friends in the state legislatures, can design and custom make their own congressional districts. Well, that also, given the current political configuration, is a recipe for frozen Republican control of the House of Representatives. And, you know, one of the rays of light in this campaign is the development of instant runoff voting in San Francisco. It was just adopted in Burlington, Vermont, and I think in a couple other places. The Democrats and progressives in this country have got to begin to challenge the frozen institutional underpinnings of monopoly Republican power over our politics.
We're talking with Jamin Raskin. He is a law professor at American University about the consolidation of Republican power in this country after the elections. Jamin, I was just reading a quote in the news headlines of Richard Viguerie. He is a leading conservative Christian who said, "Now comes the revolution. If you don't implement a conservative agenda now, when do you?" In a memo sent to other conservative Christians, Viguerie wrote, "Make no mistake, conservative Christians and values voters won this election for George W. Bush and Republicans in Congress." He went on from there and talking about how this is the moment. Can you respond?
Obviously, the Republicans did well appealing to their religious base in the country. It's clearly a numerical minority in the country, and yet they do have decisive power in the Republican Party, which means that we have sort of a minority ideological agenda driving the entire train of government. And I'm hoping that this is what does cause a backlash in this race. I was puzzled along the way in the election how the Republicans continually invoked abortion, specifically talking about so-called partial birth abortion, and Kerry and Edwards did not emphasize pro-choice, which I think does appeal to millions of independent and even Republican women voters in the suburbs. And they didn't appeal to the values of the liberal base. in the country to try to bring those voters over. And so they sort of let them wander on this sort of security mom cluster of appeals that the Republicans were making. I do think there's a pro-choice majority in this country. The Republicans very cleverly developed an issue out of thin air, this partial birth abortion issue, which relates only to several hundred medical cases in the entire country every year. I mean, it's a freakishly unusual procedure, and yet somehow the Democrats have been cornered on that, and the fundamental issue of women's right to choose has been lost in the process. You know, I think the rhetoric of values has got to be turned around. Everybody's got values. The idea that some people voted on the war, some people voted on the economy, and some people voted on values is just absurd. Everyone has values, and everyone brings values to their understanding of these different issues. And the thing that frightens me is the way that an eroding public school system and very powerful religion in some parts of the country and television on all over the place is leading to a steady dumbing down of the American public and a corrosion of basic critical thinking in the population.
What about the issue of the Electoral College? There was obviously hope among many people that if there had been a second consecutive skewing of the popular vote versus the Electoral College vote, that it might finally begin to develop a movement to get rid of the Electoral College, which right now is rendering certainly some of the major states that like New York and California, with so much population, but basically are irrelevant to the national political scene.
Yeah, I mean, the Electoral College radically depresses turnout. It renders millions of votes irrelevant to the process. I mean, there could have been, again, a difference in the popular and in the Electoral College votes. Imagine if Kerry had gotten 300,000 votes more in Ohio. He would have won Ohio. He would have won the election, although Bush still would have had a couple million votes more because of the inflated totals coming out of the southern states. But the bottom line is that until we move to a direct popular vote, we're never really going to know where the majority of the people are because the campaigns take place in the swing states. And we somehow have become accustomed to the idea that the people of 40 states are going to sit back and be television spectators to the presidential campaign that takes place in 10 states where the campaigns design their appeals to swing blocks of voters in a handful of the swing states. That's not a popular way of electing a president.
For the layperson, Jamie Raskin, can you explain why it works that way, why it comes down to these few states and why the Electoral College determines that strategy?
Well, right now we know that we know who's going to win in the vast majority of states. So we knew that Kerry was going to take New York and Connecticut and Rhode Island and California, and we knew that Bush was going to take everywhere in the South except for Florida. That may have been up for grabs. Texas and Utah and Alaska. And so it's a simple waste of money for the campaigns to put any money, any energy or resources into those states when the money has to go to the so-called swing states, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Oregon. And that's where all of the attention goes. And the turnout rate in those states is much higher.
But why is that determined by the Electoral College?
Well, each state gets a number of electors equal to the number of people it has in its House delegation plus the two senators. And this was the system that was engineered at the time of the writing of the Constitution, specifically by the small states, by the white power brokers in the southern states who pushed for the Electoral College system. And by the way, if there's a failure in the Electoral College, if there's a tie, then the presidential election is thrown into the House of Representatives where the states vote, but not according to population, with each state casting one vote. So New York and California would each get one vote, but so would Utah and South Carolina and Alabama and so on. So you see the way in which there's a kind of a structural rigging of the process that goes back to the very beginning. And what we really need to be doing is talking about constitutional reform. The problem is that the disease of this disproportionate concentration of political power kills the cure because it's the people who are in power now who get to decide because we need a two-thirds vote in the House and the Senate and three-quarters of the states to ratify any constitutional change, even a very basic one, such as constitutionalizing the right to vote, which the Supreme Court in Bush versus Gore told us in 2000 is not part of our Constitution. The court said it's not the right of the people to vote in each state, it's the power of the legislators to appoint the electors. And so the Florida legislature had threatened to disregard the popular vote if the Florida Supreme Court succeeded in getting all of them counted and just appointing the electors for Bush. And the Supreme Court said that was fine. So I think that we have to acknowledge that although we talk about democracy, democracy is always channeled and structured in particular ways. And those are ways now that are benefiting the Republican Party, and the Republican Party has figured out how to manipulate all of the levers of power.
Jamin Raskin, as we wrap up, final comment and observation, conclusions as we come out of this victory for President George W. Bush.
Well, I had a professor in college who taught me that politics is the art of doing the same thing over and over again until one day it works, and that it sort of looks like a miracle. The progressive forces should have their eyes open about what we're up against in terms of the structure of our government. And yet, I think through popular education about the nature of the government, through popular education about the threats to our civil rights, to our civil liberties, we can reach across the political spectrum to other people who are unnatural allies, like libertarians, who I think have every reason to be freaked out about the Orwellian big business, militarist, imperialist direction of the Bush administration, to create new allies, new formations, new coalitions, to be creative, and to use the fact that Bush has to try to solve the crises of his own making in Iraq and in our economy, and we have the opportunity to go out and educate.
Jamin Raskin, thank you very much for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
Law professor at American University. Thank you. When we come back, we'll be joined by Bob Perry and Esther Kaplan. We'll talk about the values voter, what that means, and we'll also talk about the media infrastructure that enabled this victory. Stay with us. Bragg and Wilco singing Christ for President, lyrics by Woody Guthrie. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We're joined by Esther Kaplan with God on Their Side, How Christian Fundamentalists Trampled Science, Policy, and Democracy in George W. Bush's White House is her new book. And on the phone with us is Bob Perry, former Newsweek and AP reporter, does a lot of reporting at consortiumnews.com on politics today. His latest piece, Too Little, Too Late. But I wanted to begin with Esther Kaplan as we look at the consolidation of Republican power. One of the people who is a rising star in the Republican Party in the Senate is a doctor, Dr. Coburn from Oklahoma, who just won the Senate seat there. Can you talk about his story and how that gives us a picture of the increasing Christian conservative power right now?
Well, Coburn, he'll be a freshman in the Senate, but I think he's certainly someone to watch. He's a very effective politician. He actually came in as a congressman during the Gingrich Revolution, but after a couple of terms, he went home. That was part of the Gingrich platform, was term limits, so he kind of stayed true and went back to Oklahoma to work as an OBGYN again after that. became a board member of the Family Research Council, which is one of the most important Christian right organizations in Washington. I've interviewed him before. He's proudly and openly anti-gay. I think people may know he's famously in the past, not so recently, called for the death penalty for abortionists. There was a scandal during his campaign.
He's an obstetrician.
He is. That he had sterilized one of his patients without her consent. It's something that ended up in court. Despite all that, he won handily in Oklahoma. He actually wasn't even expected to get the Republican nomination there, let alone win. James Dobson, who's the head of Focus on the Family, who actually took a leave from his nonprofit position in order to really dig in politically to this campaign, worked very hard for George Bush and very hard for Tom Coburn.
James Dobson, Christian Focus on the Family, based in Colorado Springs.
Exactly. One of the most massive Christian media empires. And he...
How many radio stations are they on? What, some more
well,
than
they're
700?
Syndicated, but he reaches, his broadcasts reach millions, and he also has a publishing house and et cetera. But he, from the moment Tom Coburn's website went up, there was a letter of endorsement from James Dobson on it. And I think that his victory is a kind of example of the way that these anti-gay marriage ballot initiatives really influence turnout in key states. There was one on the ballot in Oklahoma. It was a wipeout in opposition to gay marriage. And I think that that combination of turning out for Coburn, turning out for Bush, turning out against gay marriage really brought the
all
evangelical
vote. All 11 states where gay marriage bans were on the ballot. They
won decisively.
Won.
I think the lowest was around 60%. In Mississippi, it was, I think it might have been higher than 85%. Now, this is, you know, all the polls show that this is something that's only going to work to the right's advantage for 10 or 20 years because there's a real generation gap on this issue. But for now, it was extremely effective. I think that when we look at Ohio and Bush's victory in Ohio, we'll see when all the numbers sort out. But I actually think that the turnout for the ballot initiatives against gay marriage, completely exempted from campaign financing limits, that turnout effort, led by the grassroots Christian right, probably was decisive in Ohio for Bush, too.
And of course, it is a tactic that the of using referendum to at critical junctures inflate or change the nature of the vote that the Democratic Party has not been very good at using in any of its races. But I'd like to ask you, in terms of this whole issue of the Christian fundamentalism, this is a continuing theme throughout American history. I mean, if you go back to going back to the battles between the those who were more followers of Puritanism and among the founding fathers over the role of the church within our government versus the Jeffersonians, Madison, and Franklin, and those who were more of the Enlightenment strain. But it seems to have definitely grabbed hold at this particular time again, because there have been periods in American history where the fundamentalist vote has arisen. Why now has it arisen again?
Well, it's interesting when you bring up the history, because it was actually very significant on the progressive side at another point in our history, fueling the abolition movement and the some of the social reforms around the turn of the century and so on. There was, in this case, starting with the defeat of Goldwater in 1964, a concerted effort to peel off this group, which was really in political retreat, still a significant movement within the United States, but really had divorced itself from political life, from public life. There was a concerted effort to recruit that movement into the Republican Party, and it took 30 years, but it really worked, and that began with the organizations that cropped up in the 70s, the National Right to Life Committee, the Eagle Forum, Jerry Falwell's Moral Majority. All of this was kind of called into being by Republican operatives like Richard Viguerie, like Paul Weyrich, who really saw this as the way for the Republicans to regain a majority. And it looks like after all of their hard work, it's really panned out. I mean, we don't know the numbers exactly, But Karl Rove famously, after 2000, said, you know, we lost the popular vote because evangelical conservatives did not turn out in the numbers we wanted. He vowed to turn them out in greater numbers. The early indications are that that probably worked. The poll, the exit polling questions were phrased very differently in 2000 and 2004, so the direct comparisons are tough. But it looks like at least a few percentage points, maybe even more, bump up in the turnout. And that really helped contribute to not just the Electoral College victory, but the popular vote victory.
Interesting comment of Fareed Zakaria on ABC News. He said, this is what really divides the U.S. from other industrial democracies, God's gaze and guns, if you will. If you were to take a sampling of public opinion in countries all around the world, and this has been done by the Pew Foundation, you'd find that the United States, on most of the core cultural issues, is much closer to Nigeria and Saudi Arabia than to Europe and Japan.
Well, that's a sad comment, but it's true. We're completely out of step with other industrialized democracies.
I want to talk about the media infrastructure that some say facilitated this and bring Robert Perry into this conversation, former Newsweek and Associated Press reporter who did some of the pioneering, groundbreaking exposés on the Iran-Contra affair in the 1980s. Bob Perry's latest piece, Too Little, Too Late, says, George W. Bush's electoral victory is chilling proof that the conservatives have achieved dominance over the flow of information to the American people, and that even a well-run Democratic campaign stands virtually no chance for national success without major changes in how the news media operates. Robert Perry, can you expand on this?
Well, Amy, really for the past quarter century or so, the conservatives and the Republicans have been working very assiduously to build their own media infrastructure. Much of that came out of the bitterness they felt after the Watergate ouster of Richard Nixon, the defeat in Vietnam, which they blamed in some part on elements of the American public that had turned against the war. So the conservatives went out very, and we know they're, we have their thinking and their writings on this, to build their own establishment and, in large part, to build their own media. They began with money from conservative foundations. Later on, Reverend Moon stepped in with hundreds of millions of dollars that he brought in for the Washington Times and other publications. Later on, the talk radio came into this, and eventually Fox News. So it's really almost a vertically integrated media infrastructure that the conservatives now have, and it reaches across the country. It reaches into many of these smaller towns in these rural areas where much of what we've been talking about has happened, and a big part of what the conservative media has done is to demonize liberals, to make liberals simply something that Americans don't want to be near, and at least many Americans. So that's been the goal, and it's been very successful. By contrast, on the liberal Democratic side, there's been a lot less investment in media. Not that there isn't any, but it's much, much less, and the focus has been much different. So the conservatives have really achieved a tremendous success, I think, because they have invested over time, over a long period of time, assiduously in year in, year out media, not something that's put together for the campaign, but put together for constant working their messages, getting their messages to their base, recruiting new people, and demonizing their enemies.
But, Bob, the argument that many of these conservative media outlets constantly espouse and many of their listeners also repeat is that the liberals have their own media in the so-called national press, the New York Times, the Washington Post, CBS and ABC and so forth, and that they are constantly, in fact, you can't find probably people who criticize the quote national media as much as those from the conservative movement in the United States.
Right, but it's largely a myth. What you have in the corporate or mainstream media is not a liberal media. It's only liberal, I suppose, in the context that if you put it up against some of the hard right positions. But the position of the major media has been to try to be centrist. When I was at Newsweek, we'd talk about how the goal of Newsweek was to be in the center. Now, obviously, that means that as things move to the right, you know, your journalism moves to the right. if you want to stay in the center. So what we've seen is this phenomenon of the mainstream press, which is deathly afraid of being called liberal. And this is true not just for organizations, but for individual journalists. They're afraid of being called liberal because it damages their careers. So they have moved also more to the right and trying to finesse this development. To consider the mainstream press liberal is, I think, is just mythical. It doesn't exist. And there are obviously liberals in the media, but overall, the mainstream press, it tries to be centrist, whatever that means.
Bob Perry, you said the investment in the non-right-wing media goes in different places. What do you mean by that?
Well, overall, the Democrats and the liberals have not seen media as their priority. They've invested more in either activism or in things like projects like buying up endangered wetlands or helping to support AIDS research, certainly worthy causes. But they have not invested in the way the conservatives have in this sort of strategic approach toward media. That is, if you build a strong media that makes your points, puts your arguments before the people, recruits more, that will help you ultimately get control of the government. There's been more of a stopgap approach on the left. As we saw during this campaign period, there were groups that were set up just for the 2004 campaign that raised money for advertisements. And those advertisements went on mainstream corporate media. They were paid for. And then after that was done, it disappears. There's no residual effect, whereas the conservatives have built institutions that continue day in, day out, year in, year out, putting their message across, being consistent, and being out there so the American people can listen to them.
It's interesting. The University of Maryland just came out with a study, American Public on International Issues, found that 75% of Bush supporters continue to believe Iraq was providing substantial support to al-Qaeda, and that the majority, again, still believe weapons of mass destruction were found in Iraq.
Well, that makes sense, because what the people are hearing across the country when they tune in their AM dial and they're on a long drive or they're a truck driver and they're not working that way, they're going to be hearing these kinds of messages constantly being presented. And when there is honest reporting in the mainstream press, it can be disparaged as liberal and not to be believed. So you have a large number of Americans who have really reached that point that they believe the propaganda that they get from the conservative media. And that has changed American politics dramatically.
Robert Perry, I want to thank you for being with us. Bob Perry is author of the book Secrecy and Privilege, Rise of the Bush Dynasty from Watergate to Iraq. It's a new book. And Esther Kaplan is author of With God on Their Side. That does it for the program. A remarkable team produces Democracy Now! Mike Burke, Sharif Abdel-Quddus, John Hamilton, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, Jeremy Scahill, Mike DeFilippo, and Ryan Abernathy engineered today's show. Tonight I'll be at Stanford University in California at the Aurora Forum Town Meeting Kresge Auditorium. Tomorrow night, San Diego at the First Unitarian Church. On Sunday, St. Petersburg, Florida at the St. Petersburg Times Festival of Reading at Eckerd College. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.